Colin Ryder Richardson, Reel 3. Yes, I was asking you, you know, about morale earlier, Colin. And, you know, was there anything you did to really either comfort yourself or keep the spirits up of other people?
Well, yes, I mean, people sort of say that, you know, singing Rule Britannia and a few other noble songs that's come to mind, but it was very impractical because of such heavy weather. One tries to do your best or work in a collective way, but when you're 11 years old and you're in a boat full of adults, you feel that you're one waiting for other people to do the responses to the situation, whatever they may be. It's all so sudden and quick, and you really haven't any idea what to do. But I mean, we were on the lookout for the first time to see if we were rescued from other people, or helping other people, or whatever we could do. And we were trying to think of keeping our spirits up in a way, but although we sang a few songs, I think the overwhelming storm soon put paid to keeping up this morale boosting work that we were trying to do, and, you know, shouting to other people, anybody there, is there anybody out there, can we help, and that sort of stuff. Because if you're in the seas without a lifeboat, the end is pretty quick. So one becomes slightly ruthless about the whole situation, you know, trying to be helpful when the reality was, if you weren't on a piece of life raft or wreckage, your chances of survival were nil. Even if you were wearing a lifebelt.
You were saying in the beginning, you know, with the 40 people, you know, approximately 40 on or around the lifeboat, people were in the water hanging on. Mm. Were there many people in the water?
Yes. But you see, with the oil and everything else, it made their lives totally terrible. They were covered in oil. They couldn't hang on. They just slipped away. There's no way that any of us in the lifeboat could really help, because if you stood up, you were likely to be swept out of the lifeboat. So there was just absolutely no way any of us could really offer practical help, like two people together pulling a person out of the water into the lifeboat. It was a question of hang on or you're gone. And that was the cruel reality of the situation. And there were people of all ages. I didn't see many children. But as I say, I think the children were confined to other lifeboats on another part of the ship. So I was mainly with adults, sailors, passengers. And one could only say, well, if you can get into the lifeboat, that is, you know, you're welcome. But there isn't much room, and it's not going to be easy. And that sort of thought's gone through me, you know, if one could have done anything more. But as far as I was concerned, at 11 years old, it was just the impossibility. So it was only a question of just kind of talking to the nurse in my arms or talking to anybody else between the waves and say, yes, I was all right. Have we got anything to eat, or is there anything we can put round somebody or other? it's so difficult. I'll say singing seemed to be difficult to.
And you were waterlogged, you know, up to your chest the whole time, were you, until rescue?
Yes.
Was there was no way, given the waves, that you could get rid of the water?
No, it was ridiculous. It was just sitting deep in the water, and the waves were just going through and out the other side. And in many ways, I suppose, it was. Gave me life, but more stability than if it had been normally, as it should have been, floating. If it had been floating, you could have easily been overturned. The waves are so large. That was the point. I mean, these were surfing waves. They were waves that were curling over. That was the incredible thing. You couldn't think of them like that. But you could appreciate that if the lifeboat was not afloat as it is designed to be, one of the big curling waves crashing down on you would just take the lifeboat up, turn it over on its bottom upwards, and that would be that. That's why other survivors were clinging to an upturned lifeboat, because in some extraordinary way, it's a better way up from the point of view for heavy storms, because it's more stable. So, in a way, because our lifeboat sank to its water tanks, it's because it was so much in the water, it's inherently very much more stable. But of course, I noticed that my skin was all getting very soft. That was another thing. If you leave your hand immersed in water for 20 hours, the value of the hands becomes nil. I mean, your skin is so soft, it's just because it's just been permeated with the water. It all goes a little wrinkly and white. And of course, it was very cold indeed. Very cold.
Mm-hmm. And your legs and feet. You were in thin pyjamas anyway, weren't you? How did the cold and the wet affect the rest of you?
I don't know if I really felt my legs at all. I lost my slippers. That was that day went as well. Feeling yesterday when we saw the destroyer, I mean, it was almost beyond belief. See a destroyer turn up so quickly, knowing that they'd been possibly many miles away, because we were in what was called the middle of the Atlantic, without any naval craft around, because they were busily escorting ships. And they came alongside us, and they had scrambling nets over the side of the destroyer, and they asked us to climb up. But it was impossible, and my hands were so soft that I was so stiff, and my life jacket sort of more or less held me in one position, that I was just basically a statue in the lifeboat. I hadn't moved. Reality, apart from going up and down with the waves, since I got in it 20 hours earlier. So the sailors came down off the destroyer, and I think the same as for the other survivors of our boat. None of them could get up. I think maybe the ship's officer was able to clamber up. But other than that, so we had rope put round our armpits, and we were hauled up onto deck and taken straight into the gallery of the engine room, where the warmth from the engines was coming up, and we could get rid of our wet clothes and dry out and get some clothes. I'm just amazed how young the crew were. I mean, I was 11, but some of the crew were only about 7 years older than me on the destroyer. And the captain was considered to be the old man at 23. And here it was in a huge destroyer, a large complement of crew, and the responsibility of such young men. It was just amazing. But it made me very welcome indeed. But of course, their resources for picking up survivors was pretty limited. And I think we were taken down to the wardroom with whatever they could find, and just told to lie down and recover, and give them warm drinks. And the surgeon came round to see us to ensure, you know, if we got any wounds or things. Another thing, as far as I was concerned, was the oil was just everywhere. It was in my hair, and my mouth, under my nails, everywhere. And it was the oil from the liner. But they gave us hot showers when we were more recovered, and to get rid of the salt, because the salt's also in your skin everywhere, and really we needed rest, which is the main thing. And then we were warned that the ship was going to try to depth charge the submarine, so we would have to be aware that there would be some loud explosions and the ship would manoeuvre very quickly. And that caught me unawares when it actually did happen, because when the ship, when the destroyer heels over at full speed, it certainly goes over at a very, very sharp angle indeed. And I've still got the bump in the back of my head.
Were you injured?
Well, I suppose I was, but I mean, after my survival, anything didn't really matter. There was certainly a very severe blow on the back of my head. Mm-hmm. Just caught a pipe or something like that. I mean, I was holding on, but I never appreciated just how far that destroyer would lean over as it turned to go on its depth charging run. Didn't get the submarine, but it obviously had a contact. Of course, we'd taken from the 30th to the 17th of September to get out to where we were. So basically, it was 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 5 days. And I think the destroyer picked us up on the 18th. And I think by the 19th or the 20th of September, we were back in Greenock.
Had you picked up any of the other survivors at this time? You
yes.
Know,
I didn't really know quite what was happening, because they attended to our needs as we came on board, and then as our needs were being satisfied, they then put us to rest somewhere, but other people and other things were happening, and the destroyer was constantly stopping and starting to pick up the people and the survivors. But of course, it all had to be done very quickly, because there's no knowledge as to whether or not the submarine was in the area, and the destroyer itself would be vulnerable. So, I mean, it was a matter of quick in and out. The operation was very efficient and very quick indeed. And one could understand you didn't want to hang around in an area where you could be torpedoed a second time. So you ask no questions, and when you were told to, you know, stay there, lie down, see if you get some sleep, that's exactly what you did. There was nothing else you could do, because the ship was in action. When I showed you a picture of the of us resting on the deck, mean, the other two youngsters beside me, I mean, at that time I don't think I knew them. I made some friends, and I can't remember their names. And those two next to me, we were just put there as casualties, if you like, just to rest up. But of course, the next day, it was a lovely sunny day, and it was very nice to be back on board ship. Nice food. The sailors couldn't do enough for us. Whatever we wanted, we got, if they could get it. Well, I was given a pair of golfing trousers, plus fours, because they were about the shortest in the leg anybody had on board, and they went over my feet anyway. And some sweater, I think a naval sweater. The wireless operator gave me his badge as a memento. They haven't given much to give us in the way of presents or gifts or even things to wear. And we arrived back in Greenock, and it was only as we started to come off the ship that we began to see, oh, hello, glad to see you, because they'd been probably put in another part of the ship for the journey home. So I think I really met the Sonia and Derek when we finally landed and we got into some assembly shed of customs, and we could see who was who and what was what, and asked how they got on and where they hurt and everything else like that. And we were confronted by asking for our passports. Which brought out a hollow laugh. It was about the first thing that made us laugh. And what if we to declare, which gave us a laugh? I had to confess that I'd still had £10 my father's in my wallet, stuck in my jacket pocket. It was rather soggy. I still got that. And then they took us to an office where there was some, I think, women's voluntary services had got some spare clothing. And we tried to sort out anything that would fit us. And to be frank, there was nothing, because children's clothes, I suppose, get probably handed on to other children and don't get handed necessarily in. Small boys' clothes anyway get easily worn out. So we got into the situation that a bus was laid on for us, and we were taken into Glasgow in this bus. And because nobody really knew what to do with us, we were taken into the Central Hotel in Glasgow. And I was wearing out my dried out pyjamas now, because I'd returned my trousers that I'd got off the ship to. Again. I had this extraordinary sensation of walking into the Central Hotel, one of the top hotels in Glasgow, wearing just my pyjamas and my life jacket, my K-pop life jacket. And nobody took a blind of notice. It was as if it was the most normal thing. And all at once, the newspaper reporters were upon us. Some had met us at Greenock, some reporters, and taken photographs of us. But everything was so confusing. I had no idea what our telephone number was at home in Wales. The phone system was virtually non-existent anyway. I had no real money apart from my £10 that my father got. No pennies for coin-operated things. Nobody seemed to quite know what to do next. But the Derek and Sonia met up with her sister, Barbara, and their mother appeared. I don't know quite how, but she you got wind of the situation and got there pretty promptly. And as a short stopgap situation, rather than stay in a rather expensive hotel, she found accommodation at Balloch on the Loch Lomond. And I think we were taken out there by taxi or bus. I don't know. Probably bus. And the adults were trying to get hold of my parents, and my father, being a lawyer, he was out in practice somewhere. And I think my mother might have been in London, I don't know. But of course, they were not expecting to hear from me until I got to America, so there was absolutely no reason for them to be at the end of a phone at all. And I think that my mother heard it from somebody who said that there was this rumour that the liner had been sunk. And immediately my mother's mother began to become aware that the situation might have involved me, but it seemed such a remote likelihood, because by that time, maybe a week had passed since I left Friday, and now it was next Thursday. In the meantime, the mother of the children was, I suppose, trying to get hold of my mother, and finding it very difficult. But I think on the next day, my mother turned up, having had a horrific journey to get by trains, and she had to have an overnight train up to Glasgow and so on and so forth. And it seemed so incredible to see my mother again. It's like suddenly walking back in time. Such an adventure, that can be the right description. It really left me totally without any roots left in England, if you like, but I was now looking forward to new life in America, and suddenly I was back. So a rerun. And luckily we had Scottish relations. My mother's mother, my grandmother, was Scottish, and my mother had armed herself with contact numbers, and one of her cousins lived in Glasgow, and we went back to Glasgow, and it was decided to stay a few days in Glasgow so that I could get over the trauma. And we stayed with this bachelor, I remember rightly, who dropped all that he was doing, whatever it was, I don't know what his job or work was, and opened his apartment to us. And my mother went off to find clothes for me, and he and I went off swimming in the swimming pool, which caused my mother great amusement to think that I decided to go swimming again. But he had met this guy, no knowledge of handling swimming, he didn't quite know what to do. He said he was keen on swimming, and he could find me a swimming costume that I had to go, and it was a very good occupation to do. And then a lot of the other distant relatives suddenly turned up, and there's lots of high teas in Scottish fashion, and baps, and I remember other good food was produced. In the meantime, my father had seen a picture of us, a city picture of myself and the Bett children on the front page of the newspaper on a railway platform, and he went up to one of the passengers and said, "You know, I can't get a newspaper, but that has to be my a son. And the man hands his newspaper over. That's how my father first knew about the whole event. So he tried to ring our Welsh home, but my mother was away. And it took a long time, I think there was a sort of 10-hour delay in trying to get a phone call through to my grandparents, who were then acting as a relay for messages from wherever to wherever. Eventually, I came back to Monmouthshire. And I really sort of tried to pick up life as it was before I went. Going back to the school in Monmouthshire, it was definitely decided, although it was offered. I got a lot of offers from people in America to go again. And I said no, I think that the war was getting worse. The likelihood of it happening again was probable. In fact, the whole scheme was abandoned after the sinking of the city of Benares.
You were saying about the reporters, the people who met you. Was there a lot of publicity?
Yes, after a certain period of censorship, they weren't allowed to go straight into the newspapers because there was an embargo. They didn't want really the Germans to find out anything until they felt it was safe. The rescue ships were well away from everything. I could understand that. So, as I say, my father was one of the last people to know, because he saw it first in the newspapers and hadn't appreciated exactly what had happened. And I mean, everybody was totally flabbergasted about the whole situation. And there were a lot written in the newspapers about the event. It happened just after the fall of France, and how the Battle of Britain was on at the time. So there was a lot of news about, any minute now the German Air Force was going to bomb London out of existence and they were going to go on doing it. But even so, there's still front page news for several days. And the reality was that, Britain was then in greater danger than it had been when I had left. Things that had developed, invasion forces, the German army had been acquired, big barges and so on and so forth. And we knew this, we were told this, it was becoming a critical state in whether or not the invasion was going to take place. Called Operation Sea Lion.
Were you yourself interviewed, Colin?
Yes, quite a lot.
What sort of publicity did you yourself receive from the press?
Well, it was in all the newspapers around the world because we have relatives in South Africa, Canada, and obviously my American good friends who were going to look after me had taken every newspaper in America to read about the story and the event that was put out in every language, because it was considered to be, quite rightly, a very wicked thing to happen. The Germans responded and said they just chose the biggest ship in the convoy. They didn't know what it carried. And it was an all-out warfare, and they were perfectly entitled, as it wasn't marked up with red crosses.